This is Ron Hogan, and you are listening to Life Stories, a podcast on Beatrice.com, where I interview memoir writers about their lives and about the art of memoir writing. My guest today is Tim Anderson, the author of Tune in Tokyo, The Gaijin Diaries, and we'll be talking to him about his trip to Tokyo and about how this book actually got to be published, because there's a really interesting story behind that as well. So, welcome, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Ron.
Absolutely. So, yeah, tell us about what was going on in your life that basically made you pull up stakes from North Carolina and head over to Tokyo.
Yeah, I was in kind of a rut in my late 20s. I was working, I was living in Raleigh, which is my hometown, after doing a bit of traveling around, post-collegiate traveling. And I was working three jobs. I was just kind of floundering, and I still had the travel bug. Still kind of wanted to go see things. And one of the jobs I had was teaching English, conversational English, to international business people at Berlitz, at a local Berlitz language school. And most of my students were Japanese and Japanese men and women and their kids as well. So I was meeting a lot of Japanese families and just kind of getting interested in just Japanese culture in general. And I just kind of one day decided, I'm pretty sure it was at that the spark of the idea came from one of my students. It was like, well, you should go over there. And I started investigating, and pretty soon found a school that had many, many branches in Tokyo, and so went over and started doing it.
But you didn't get into Tokyo itself at first, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I had considered doing the JET program because you can, because it's, well, for one thing, it's frankly very well paid. But the JET program is like a government sponsored program. Where they place native English speakers around the country to teach English to children, and I considered doing that, but you have no control over where they send you. You could be sent to the ruralmost village of Japan, and while that would have been incredible in and of itself, I really wanted to go to Tokyo. So in order to do that, I went with a company that, where you could choose, the general area where you were going to go. Unfortunately, I was placed, about 45 minutes south of Tokyo at first in a town called Fujisawa. Unfortunately, I mean, it was still great and mind blowing, but it was not the heart of Tokyo like I wanted it to be. It's kind of like, you know, being sent to New Jersey, I guess, a little bit. Still quite a large town. But so it took me about, and I was working in Yokohama at first. So it took me about 5 months, I think, to make the move to Tokyo.
Right. And during that time, you're basically rooming with a lot of the other teachers as well.
Right. Like my building was, well, it wasn't 100% Gaijin foreigners. It was, to a large extent, foreigners and foreigners working for this particular language school. So my two roommates were also, they were both Australian. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and that was fun. You know, you meet people from all over the place, but it was kind of weird. It was like being in a dormitory, in a way.
And did you have a lot of? Well, I guess you probably did have preconceptions about what Japan would be like before you went over. So how much was your mind blown when you got there?
I kind of touch on this in the prologue. My preconceptions about Japan, like many people's, I think, were pretty wild. You know, we receive our information about Japan largely through pop culture. And so I kind of thought about Tokyo as this monstrous, neon-soaked, you know, dystopian futuristic city, like, of course, Blade Runner or something like that, which I think is that's a joke in the prologue. But even so, my mind was pretty blown just by that. I mean, going from, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina, which, while a growing city, is still a modestly sized American city, and you drive everywhere, you know, there are not many pedestrians. You're dissuaded from being a pedestrian, in fact. To a place where, you know, squillions of people riding trains, trains always on time. You know, a fact of life is just the absolute lack of personal space anywhere, from the time you get up until the time you go to bed, whether it be trains, you know, restaurants, you know, record stores. My favorite record store, I had to take my backpack off in order to squeeze through the stacks. And, you know, just the number of giant television screens was pretty mind-blowing. I mean, it's like Times Square everywhere.
So were there aspects of life in Tokyo and in Yokohama that you adapted to fairly early on?
I think I started doing very quickly was the whole, you know, kind of nodding and bowing slightly when you're speaking to someone out of respect. I mean, it's just kind of I don't know if I would call it a tic, but it's just something that people do when they're speaking and they're saying yes and they're understanding what you're saying and they're agreeing with you or whatever, or they're saying goodbye. And it was, you know, you're just speaking with people and you're kind of nodding. Nobody can see me, but you're not full bow, but just a kind of a nod as if you're just saying yes very quickly. And that's one thing that actually I started doing very quickly, very early on, and continued doing even after I came back until I kind of realized how weird it was to be nodding respectfully to the convenience store clerk at the gas station or whatever, and they just think you're weird. So there were things like that that I kind of took on pretty easily.
And while I recognize that, you know, gay life in Raleigh is probably no picnic, it is at least a culture that you grew up in and you recognize, yeah. And so you're familiar with it. So, again, part of the plunging, you know, halfway around the world is that as a gay man, you are also plunged into that kind of culture, which is completely foreign to you. And how do you sort of get your bearings there?
Yeah, that was an interesting experience because, you know, I did have gay Japanese friends there. Most of them, though, were closeted to their families and had no plans to come out of that closet. And so, you know, there's a tiny gay culture in a neighborhood called Shinjuku, which is downtown Tokyo. And it's called Nichome. Everybody knows what Nichome is. It means second street or something, you know. But everybody knows what you're talking about when you say Nichome. It means the gay district. And, you know, it's kind of a strange scene, the gay scene there. It's like you have places where foreigners are welcomed with open arms, and you have places that where foreigners are discouraged from going. I never really figured out why that was. I have a feeling it was because of stereotypes about AIDS and foreigners bringing AIDS into the country. I'm not totally positive about that. But it was kind of funny, like, even the bizarreness, the strangeness of another country's gay scene. You know, I've seen gay scenes, like, in cities in Europe and stuff like that. In Japan, it was kind of amusing how even all the way across the world, you could go into a gay club and still hear Mariah Carey on the stereo system or some kind of diva belting it out, you know. So that was very much like home. I'm not a big fan of that type of music, but it was still kind of comforting.
And the whole time that you're there, are you taking notes or doing a diary while you're there?
Yeah, like, well, the book started actually as a series of email newsletters I was sending to people, just people in my email list, contacts list, and I would, you know, send a story or two every week, and it just became a thing that I started doing. I hadn't planned on really doing it, but I mean, you know, when you're a writer and you are going through this kind of crazy experience, you just naturally start doing it.
Right, and that's something we should emphasize, is that when you studied writing, and even when you were doing the three jobs in Raleigh, your ultimate aspiration was writing.
Right, yeah, and I had gone to Japan to kind of force myself into a completely foreign environment to not necessarily to write a book about Japan. I really hadn't considered doing that until I started living it. I had another idea that I was wanting to work on, and so it was just like, you know, going away to write. Of course, that's kind of counterintuitive, because most people, when they go away to write, they go away to a quiet place, like a cabin in the woods or whatever, like hotel room, you know, they go somewhere where they can get something done. So in a way, it was a really bad idea to go to Tokyo to work on something else. But when I got there and I started just kind of accumulating these experiences, I would write them out and send them to people. And the response was really good. People were like, oh, these are great, you know. And so eventually I started kind of thinking about collecting them into a book, and came up with an outline. And I actually came up with an outline, you know, even before I left, and then started writing it in earnest when I came back.
And when you tried, you know, shopping the manuscript around, once you had a manuscript and right. showing it to people, what kind of reaction were you getting?
It was interesting, because, you know, when you've got to do your book proposal. That's one of the hoops you have to jump through. You have to do your book proposal. One part of the book proposal is to investigate competing titles. And I really, you know, titles that are in some way similar to yours, and then you need to explain how yours is different and brings something new to the table. And, you know, I didn't find that many competing titles. And I found a few from at least a decade ago. But I really hadn't found many. And, but the impression a lot of editors had was that this had already been done. That the Foreigner in Japan book had already been written. And even though I was bringing the kind of gay sensibility to it, it wasn't enough of a new thing. And that impression just kind of mystified me, because, you know, looking for these, where are these books? Show me these books, because I'm not finding them. So it was kind of just like an impression that people had without any real truth behind it. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that I was up against. And it was the main thing I was up against, I think. It was hard to convince the marketing people at a lot of the publishers we were approaching.
Right, because you did get an agent eventually.
Yes, yeah. I did get an agent. And I got an agent for the book pretty quickly. I didn't search around too long. I think that was just lucky that I happened to, not that the book was so brilliant, but that mm-hmm. I just happened to hit the right person early on. She was shopping it around, and we got, you know, nice responses. We got complimentary responses, but the bottom line is no one was willing to put their money down on it or to make an offer because of the marketing department's skepticism of its saleability. Where does it go on the bookshelf? What, you know, how do we market it to the public? Who's going to buy it?
So how do you end up from there to the decision to self-publish on basically as an ebook through Amazon?
Well, so after we've after my agent and I had come to the point of, well, we've hit a brick wall where she was not going to pitch it anymore, and so I started moving on to the next book that I had in my head, that I'm currently working on, and but I just I was getting I had a few chapters down, and I just had this feeling that I really knew there was an audience for this book. I just knew it. And because it's so easy these days to self-publish, it was not something I had really seriously considered before. But once I was to this point, I did really start to seriously think about it. And I actually self-published it through CreateSpace,
Okay.
which is the Amazon, it's the Amazon affiliated self-publishing firm. It used to be called BookSurge. Now it's called CreateSpace. And so I was able to, I basically laid it out myself. I had an editor friend of mine copy edit and proof it, and put the whole thing together, put it out, and sent it out into the world. Well, sent it out to an Amazon page. That was basically the only place I was able to sell it. I couldn't really get it into bookstores. Although I did get it in random bookstores here and there, and libraries as well. I heard from people who found it in the Austin Library. And so a few months later, that was June 2010. In the fall of 2010, Publishers Weekly started. They announced that they were going to do that. They were going to start doing a self-publishing quarterly. A quarterly kind of listing and review of self-published titles that are out there, just because there are so many now, so I decided to submit mine for review, and I happened I they ended up liking it. They ended up giving it a really good review, and it was from there that Amazon found me. Amazon Publishing, the imprint called Amazon Encore, which is actually the imprint that's devoted to re-releasing self-published titles that they want to bring to a larger audience.
Right, because basically they have all this sales data at their fingertips.
Exactly.
And so if they're seeing a self-published success story like yours, they're like, okay, what can we apply our muscle behind that.
Right, exactly. And I have to say, I wasn't too, I was not familiar with Amazon's publishing program at that point. Maybe I perhaps should have been, but I knew CreateSpace is all I knew about Amazon publishing. But I've learned a lot since then. Of course, they've been building it. I think they put their first books out in 2009, so it's still very young. But they've been building it ever since. And they were, people can say what they want about Amazon, but they were fully on board. They are book people. My marketing team, my editor there, they were book people, and I had a publicist here in New York, publicity firm, and they were getting it in, getting it in, getting it buzz. And my experience with them has just been incredible. I mean, we talked before, one of the downsides is that, bookstores hate Amazon so much. So my book is actually, Toon in Tokyo, is not in a whole lot of bookstores. It's in some. It's at the Strand, which is a great one to be in. I love being in the Strand here in New York City. But the po a lot of bookstores have a kind of no Amazon publishing books policy. And so that's one thing we are up against. But Amazon has been really, really focusing on sales of the Kindle ebook, and the numbers there have been pretty good, steady, and I think there's been a word of mouth buzz happening over the book in the past few months. So my experience has been great so far.
And you mentioned that you were already sort of starting a second project when this idea came to you. How is that second project coming along?
It's coming along pretty well. I, of course, my time was taken away from it once I decided to go whole hog and put the book out myself, because I figured, you know, one of the reasons that self-publishing has a bad rep from some people is because it does not look professionally done. And I wanted to try to have my self-published version as looking as professional and well done and neat and clean as possible. And so I did spend a lot of time on having that happen. So I wasn't able to really to delve into the writing on the other project for a little while. But after I self-published, I got back into it, and I almost have a full draft of it. And then, of course, there'll be a lot of rewriting and rewriting, but it's coming along really well. It's like I'm working on the elevator pitch for it, but it's like a gay diabetic memoir of adolescence in the 80s, because I was diagnosed type 1 diabetic when I was 15, when I was in the kind of the throes of adolescent hormonal angst. So.
That must be a much different type of memoir for you, because, I mean, Tune In Tokyo, as you said, you had the sort of like email newsletter to start with, and then you realized that you should be writing about this stuff as it's happening. But here you're going back.
Like,
I'm assuming like 15, 20 years or so.
Yeah. I mean, it largely takes place in high school and college. And so, yeah, I mean, I've had this book in the back of my head for many years. So it was really enjoyable to write. I mean, the voice is very similar, because it's taking the same kind of approach. The writing style is very similar to Tune In Tokyo, but it is a little more personal, because I think you have to go there if you're writing about adolescence and the things that you're going through in that time. I mean, it's still a kind of a lighthearted romp, but it has like a kind of a heavy, a little more of a heaviness to it, I think.
And do you see how your voice is changing as a writer over the course of these two books?
Yeah, I mean, I'm it comes easier, to put it just straightforwardly. I mean, I was struggling with the project I was working on before Tune In Tokyo, just because I was still kind of feeling out what voice I was trying to present, what I was doing. And with Tune In Tokyo, I burst through. Like and maybe it was because I wasn't intent on writing a book about it, so I didn't have that kind of that feeling of, oh, I'm writing a book. I need to be serious. I need to do this, do that. I need to be impressive. It was just coming out. And so I took the voice that was present in those email newsletters, and I developed the voice for Tune In Tokyo around that. And so I'm that there are echoes of that style of writing in the new one. I mean, one interesting thing that I've noticed people saying on Amazon reviews and stuff, not everybody has this impression, but that it's kind of like blog writing, because it's very kind of casual and chatty. And I think to a certain extent that's probably true. I think it's very, people have told me that it feels like they're just hanging out with someone, which I think is a pretty good compliment. It means that it's engaging, at least.
Cool. And so any last bits of advice for writers, young writers who are thinking about going halfway around the world to jumpstart their creative lives?
Oh, yeah, do it. Do it. I have heard from a few folks who happened upon the book and read it and were kind of inspired to rethink their hesitation to go anywhere or to do whatever they had been wanting to do, whether it be travel or just staking out a new territory or, you know, whatever. So it's kind of funny. Like I one reader told me that I had inspired them to do something, and it's kind of makes me laugh that I'm inspirational to someone, because that's not exactly what I was intending. I just wanted to write a funny book, but definitely do it. Definitely do it. And you won't regret it. I mean, there's no regretting doing something like this.
Awesome. Well, thank you. We have been talking with Tim Anderson, the author of Tune in Tokyo, The Gaijin Diaries, published by Amazon Encore. I'm Ron Hogan, and this has been Life Stories, a podcast about memoirs and memoir writing, run through Beatrice.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again for another great interview. Take care.